in social service at present, but I will probably become an associate in ministry sometime this fall. I have some information to present, and we'll start the taping now. The format for today's discussion, which on the kiosk says personal and community journeys in ecological spirituality. I'd like to preface our discussion that I'd like to have for the last part or last half of our time together with some information and a summary of some of the major ideas that we have covered this week as just kind of an introduction and to lay the foundation for our discussion. One of the main points and the main resources that I'm using is the book published in the last 6 months by Rosemary Radford Ruther, Gaia and God. And if you haven't heard the definition of Gaia, I would like to give that now. Most of us know who God is, but this Gaia idea is a new, old idea, but is coming to fore because her point is that we have missed out on some of the voices that, in fact, are in our Judeo-Christian tradition, but that we have lost track of these strands. And one of the strands that many people even in other religious traditions have latched onto and named Gaia because of this. The Gaia is the word for the old Greek earth goddess, and it is also a term adopted by a group of planetary biologists such as James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, and it refers to their thesis, their idea that the entire planet is one living organism, a whole system, just like our human bodies are one self-contained system. And Lewis Thomas, a biologist, wrote about this in the early 70s after the astronauts landed on the moon. And he saw that all those photographs that we saw too, our Earth is one moving and fluctuating reality. And he even knew back then about the ozone layer that is our skin. It's like the skin of the planet. And now our skin has got lots of cuts and holes in it. So this whole book really is an exploration of ecofeminist spirituality, looking at where we've missed out on some important ideas that may help to heal our human relations and our planet. Quite a big task in one book, but I'll share another way that Gaia, the term Gaia, has been used recently. It has caught on among those seeking a new ecological spirituality as a religious vision. Gaia is seen as a personified being, an immanent divinity. Some see, and here's where the problem has lain, that the Jewish and Christian male monotheistic God is a hostile concept that rationalizes alienation from and neglect of the earth. And that they say that Gaia could replace God as our focus of worship. And that's the more, obviously, the extreme, wanting to reject pretty much our Judeo-Christian tradition as having been polluted in one extreme by that male monotheism, male-identified monotheism. And I want to look here at some of the juxtapositions, the opposites that she lays out in the book. I'm going to be reading from the chapter about covenant and healing, where she does eventually, even looking at these juxtapositions, she proposes that there are some healing strands for us to look at. The Bible has been made to appear to Western Christians, and she really puts the blame on how our culture has developed some influences since St. Augustine, but particularly with biblical scholars in the last couple of hundred years, who definitely come from the patriarchal perspective, male-centered and pretty much male-dominated way of thinking. But she says the Bible has been made to appear to be much more anti-nature than it is by this line of biblical interpretation. That we have been thinking in terms of a sharp dualism between history and nature, as we put up there on the board, that history was seen as the realm of the human ascending over nature, and for that reason the authentic sphere of the presence of the true God of the Bible. Nature was understood as subhuman, as the sphere of necessity, and can you see we're kind of over and against and kind of thinking in that dualistic way, that we're here and the nature is there and God's up here and everything is down here. Everything is kind of separated and divided and not in relation, not in covenant. The word covenant essentially means a relationship. They even went so far as to state, these theologians, that any kind of divine message that may even look like it's being revealed through nature or through natural phenomena, through our own senses, was a false god. And so Rosemary Ruther says that we have gone to this extreme, and perhaps it's time to start looking and balancing out our lives by looking at the other side of the whole picture. She also says at the end, and I'll read that passage at the end of this short introduction, that she says we need both sides in order to authenticate our whole tradition and that we need that balance. And she says it better than I. The Hebraic and the Hebrew understanding of the God of Israel, she says, did not set history against nature. And I'll go through a couple of ideas where she kind of turns our old biblical interpretation on its head and has us look in a new way at some of these passages. And this is exciting to me. Hebrew understanding rather experienced God as Lord of heaven and earth, whose power filled all aspects of their lives. The same steadfast love of God is present when God spread out the earth on the waters and made great lights and made the sun to rule and the moon and stars overnight, as when the God who brought Israel out from among them with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. In other words, he was active in creation and he was active in history, making Israel a nation and passing in and amongst the people there, overthrowing Pharaoh and his army. She says this is a reality in the Hebrew way of thinking of looking at the whole picture as not being divided into two halves or dualistically separated. Is hard for us Western Hemisphere thinkers because we've been so influenced by that way of thinking since the Greek philosophers. But she urges us to look at the passages themselves, and I'll read a couple of passages from Job in a minute, that the God who is made present in historical acts of deliverance is at the same time the God who made heaven and earth. And nor is it appropriate to say that the affirmation of redemption from Egypt is more important than the affirmation of God as creator. Israel experienced both divine judgment and divine blessing in relation to threatening neighbors and also in relation to nature. In storms and droughts, they praised God for deliverance from enemies and for the miracles of fertile fields and starry night skies. She wants to take this one step further and says that I want to focus on the testimony of a God who relates directly to nature. And in nature, whether or not it is a nature of benefit to humans. God is seen in creation as taking great pleasure in this work of creation. And then the creation, in and of itself, responds to God with praise. The planets and mountains, brooks, animals, and plants return this rejoicing in their relation to God. And the relationship of God in nature is often animistically interpersonal. And that means it's like a relationship between living, breathing beings. I could give you those references if you're interested in looking at those in detail. The two that I wanted to read are from Psalm 29. It speaks of God who is present in the storm, whose voice thunders over many waters, and whose thunder breaks the cedars of Lebanon, and also makes Lebanon skip like a calf and Siron like a wild young ox. All that joyfulness in creation is reflected in both the wildness of the storm and perhaps some negative results for humans when that power of nature shows us our littleness and in our speck. You know, we are a speck on the whole creation and the whole universe. In Psalm 65, God visits the earth in the rain showers, watering its furrows abundantly, blessing its growth. The earth responds with an overflowing abundance. Do you see that there's a relationship almost? You know, God acts and the earth responds. It's very relational, as we say in what's been left out of our vision and our viewing of those passages. In Psalm 65, verses 9 through 13, the hills gird themselves with joy, and the meadows clothe themselves. See, it's using human kinds of language, like these things of nature. And later, Rosemary uses the word the thou of nature, almost making it like a human, as Martin Buber talked about I and thou in human relationships. She wants us to look at the living creatures and plants of nature as a thou, which almost, you know, almost deifies, or almost, you know, it takes away from that thingliness, as they talked about, but puts nature more on par humanizes. With us. Pardon me?
Humanizes.
And humanizes. And if, I guess one of her points is that as we've heard from all of the different cultures that are represented here this week, honoring all living, all life, whatever form it takes, is honoring the source of life. All nature shouts and sings together for joy. The blessing of God's presence, she goes on, is found not only in those spheres of nature under human cultivation where humans seek benefit from nature. And this is a thought I'd like you to really consider for our discussion. In an extended rebuke to human arrogance, in the Job passage I'll read, God, who speaks to Job from the whirlwind, makes clear that God is equally present in places and times in nature to which humans have no access. We have nothing to do with what God is up to. He asks, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? When the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? Have you ever entered into the springs of the sea?" That is, you know, where the sea even originates. Do you even know anything about this? And God also speaks of the wild animals that are not under human control, reminding us again that we are a small part of the whole picture. Job 38 says, "Can you hunt the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of young lions? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God? Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer?" The wild ass scorns the tumult of the city. It doesn't hear the shouts of the driver. It ranges the mountains as its home and its pasture. Is it by your wisdom that the hawk soars? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes its nest on high? I don't know if we've looked at that passage in Job as a reminder of our relationship to nature before, but that's one of the gifts that I found in this book. Not only as we usually read it, that God speaks to Job from the whirlwind, reminding him that in our usual interpretation, we say that God has absolute power. You know, that's our. And what are some of the other interpretations of those, of that Job passage? Have you ever studied that one? Another one is that to remind us of our powerlessness, and that I've even heard a sermon by a pastor that he said that we should interpret that passage in Job to mean we shouldn't ask God questions. But then I read Psalms where they're asking God questions all the time. Why me? You know, so I kind of ignored that pastor. So. Her point is God is present not only in blessings in society and in our human relationships and nature, but also in social and natural disasters. And she even criticizes we're not supposed to sell or to differentiate social and natural. Reflects too much that dualism that she has is seen as a root of our distortions in modern day biblical interpretation. In the Hebrew texts, these phenomena, this God acting in our human relationships and setting up rules and orders for us to treat each other with respect, and also God acting in nature, is knit together in one holistic experience, in which defeats at the hands of conquering enemies and the storms and droughts that bring human works to naught are both seen as aspects of one picture that testify to divine judgment on human sin, and in both blessings and curses, success and disaster, God is sovereign and giving meaning and purpose to all events. I want to, and this may spark some discussion at this point too. Much of the ecological critique of the Bible has focused on the concept of dominion over nature granted to humans by God. You remember that passage in Genesis after the fall, I believe. Mary's looking it up for us.
Yeah, he doesn't say dominion, it says caretakers.
Aha, in the New Translation, that's what it is.
No, even in this one, that was written in the 50s, it says caretaker.
Right. Is that the revised?
Yeah, the revised, yeah.
Okay.
Just a minute, I'll find it. But I think it's wonderful, it's God made clothes for them. So David Teedy taught us when we had our word in this training. You know, how else did they get clothes after they were in these? Now, who made them for them? They didn't want to make clothes. God made them. God had a sewing machine. That's what we came to TV for his desk. It's still a little desk, a little sewing machine. Reminds me that God made their clothes.
Yeah, we don't know how a lot of things happen. Another mystery.
You keep talking off my.
Okay, the passage has been interpreted to mean, in the same way that Rosemary says that distorted thinking. From our patriarchal cultures has almost, you know, kind of forced us to think with this framework over our biblical passages, that the assumption that if there's a kingly image used, that, well, that king has absolute power and control and is male and, you know, and uses and abuses everything else and everyone else for his or, you know, own purposes. Rather a selfish picture. But the word dominion and the view of the Israelite kings was that these kings were to be first and foremost concerned for the welfare of all people. And she doesn't bring that out in this particular book, but I thought I'd better. Do you have something to add to that? Or the word dominion that has been used in some translations does mean caretaker or steward.
Do you want what God said when they left the Eden?
Yeah, what?
Behold, a man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil, and now mm-hmm. at least he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he had taken. More dominion than caretaking.
It was just after the creation.
I know, I'm going to go back to that one. Okay. I thought I had it underlined.
And we know there's two different stories of creation. Here it is, in first chapter, verse 26. Do you have that? Genesis 1, verse 26. Do you want to read that,
Mary? And God said, let us make man in our image. I like that us, by the way. After our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish in the sea, and over the birds in the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth.
Yeah, that's, and she says that's where we've gotten into trouble with our kind of Eurocentric. It means the European view of what a king is. You know, somebody who owns everything and drives the serfs and slaves to their deaths by working for the benefit of the people that own the land and the kings. We've gotten a distorted view of what the kingly job is. She puts another slant on this that I want to share with you before I do some closure to this other discussion. That Hebrew thought, here we go, human authority over nature is, there are some limits, and in fact, again, turning this whole idea of authority over nature on its head, that biblical scholars have now found that this authority over human nature always remains delegated authority. Nature is not private property to be done with as one wishes, but stewardship over an earth that remains ultimately God's creation, in God's design and in God's plan. We are here probably temporarily. We haven't been here very long in the whole span of eons of how creation has developed that we know now from geologists and the science of evolution. But God's plan, we may be only a very small part of that. Okay. And to abuse this trust of this stewardship in destructive relations to nature is to bring divine wrath upon one's head. And if you're interested, I have some of the references in the prophets, Amos and Hosea, where when we mistreat other human beings, and when the Israelites were using up the natural resources at too high a rate, and it really, especially in the Amos chapters, coordinated our abuse of other humans, as some of those kings did get pretty into their power and control and were precursors to that European system of using those slaves and serfs to their own benefit. And through our prophets, God reminded that, hey, wait a minute, this is a distortion of both what human relations are to be and also to what your living on the earth is to be. A couple of final thoughts before I'm going to throw a couple of questions at you. Hebrew thought knit the covenantal relation of God to Israel in a close relationship to the gift of the land. in chapter 5, and previously it's in this book, she shows how the concept of the promised land can be acted out in ethnocentric violence against other people whose ancient tenure in that same land is discredited because of their lack of relation to this god. She does acknowledge that, yes, there is that strand of, you know, you've got one center, one uniform, you know, one culture that is supposed to be God's chosen way of being in relationship to humans. But there are also those other strands in the old, both the Old and the New Testament, that say there's some other ways that we may be able to also explore God's plan. Israel's own tenure, again, in the land is contingent on its righteousness. The gift of the land is not a possession that can be held apart from relationship to God. Any questions on this so far? Does this make sense? Is it something that you haven't heard here before? Yeah.
Well, you've got me thinking about some of the things that happened physically to the land recently. Thinking of the flooding in the Midwest, the Mississippi and Missouri flooding, and responses by some Christian folks that clearly God is getting back at us because we're favoring abortions, or Falwell was quoted in making that analysis, that interpretation of the floods.
I mean, only the Midwesterners favor abortion.
And then I also read, at the same time, the terrible monsoons in Bangladesh, which are far more disastrous than the Mississippi flooding in terms of loss of life and land. And one person living there being quoted as saying, clearly there can't be any God, or to inflict such pain on innocent people. Mm-hmm. So we have people who are seeing natural disasters, you know, what happens to the land, in one hand being God working through nature to punish us in this case, mm-hmm. and on the other hand being evidence that there can't be a God or these things wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. Now, can you help us see how Luther would want us to think about that?
Are there any ideas from the group about that question? I always want to tap the knowledge that's here.
Well, I just know that man has built in floodplains that Native Americans never did, mm-hmm. That there's a 100-year cycle maybe of that river, and the river has its own cycle, and man has tried with the levees that are 30, 40 feet tall, mm-hmm. to say we can control nature, and I think many people in the Midwest are learning that the river is a mighty river, and that the river is the river, and we need to respect it, and so we need to figure out other ways to control it other than by man's ingenuity. I think there's that kind of thinking coming around, too, from the Midwest. But we've built places we should never have built. We've done it all over. And we're paying the consequences, just like the prophets in the Old Testament kept telling the Israelites, you know, you're doing this and it's going to cause ruin. Mm-hmm. It's not that God caused the ruin, they caused the ruin to themselves.
So your interpretation, of course, is that this is human stupidity rather than an act of God.
Well, I agree with the 100-year cycle thing because it's been proven over and over again. If you look at some of the rivers and look at soil samples 50 feet down or so, you can see that, yes, there was big floods at certain times. And so, and they are pretty much in cycles. And so that's been proven over history and saying, yes, this is true. And so, yes, one of these years we will get a big flood. Yes, something will happen here, but we don't know when. But we're predicting it's going to be around here. But so people build things to say, all right, this will protect us and give us a false sense of security. Or it might, you know, like in St. Louis's case where they had a wall just at the flood line, and here's the water and here's the flood, and it was just barely there. So Mary's case is right about the cycles, but it does work, and nature does work in cycles, and people fail to see that. sometimes.
Mm-hmm. But how do you answer what you were saying, the people that blame God for their horrible circumstance?
Or attribute God with the capability of, you know, carrying out the
murder.
Retribution. Yeah.
Murder.
Just falls.
So how do you answer that?
Right in line with the way that Jerry Falwell played. Wow.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, how do we... I want to hear from...
Well, Joseph, if we don't listen to our Josephs in the community who tell us that there's going to be 7 years of good and then 7 years of bad, mm-hmm. there's a line that indicates the cycles exist, and there are people who can predict it and who are connected to nature and God and can figure these things out. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, when you knock out 85% of your wetlands, you got to expect that sometime the drain's going to flood. I mean, you know, I think we're back to the Garden of Eden and we're screwing around with it, and God said, okay, you know, but I'm going to throw you out of here. You go mess up someplace else. This is
the same thing will happen over and over.
And so man says, well, I'm pretty powerful now. I'm like God. I think I can control this. You know, and we build along the eastern seaboards, all these cities, and you know, we build on floodplains. Bangladesh is a nation that nobody should have ever been shoved toward. I mean,
well, that's why it's only poor folk, the exceedingly poor that live there, is because it's such cheap real estate.
The Himalayan floodplain plus, you know, add the monsoons to it, and it always floods. I mean, it's always a disaster. And yet monsoons are seen as a godsend to other places. The monsoons bring the end to the drought period, just as a hurricane sometimes snaps a drought. You just are not supposed to build next. I mean, just knowing the wisdom, you just don't build next to the area where that's going to come in, or you learn to build, you know, like a temporary sort of housing.
And you certainly don't take out all the native plants and mm-hmm. trees and strong things that you can hold on to when a hurricane comes. As people, how people survive in the South Sea Islands when there are hurricanes? They just dig down in the sand and hold on to the roots.
And the plants have roots that can deal with that.
Yeah.
Same with Australia. Australia's trees deal with fire. They are fire-surviving trees. And then the Europeans brought in this other stuff that has actually gone havoc over in Australia. If you leave natural things where they belong, well, even the Northwest, Gosh Broom was brought to help when they were making our highways, they cut through mountains and hills and they were slushing down. So they bought the Scotch broom in to root up the size of the hill.
Oops.
Yes, you know, it's hay fever and everything else caused because of this thing. But anyway, we can't do that. We just can't do that.
The Ruther would take it even a couple of steps further, and you intimated that. She quotes Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson on how we have really abused the land in the Midwest in particular, and that's where Wes Jackson's work with the Land Institute is centered. That she relates this to the way agribusiness is done by multinational corporations, and she exposes some of these things that we're not even aware of. And I'd urge you to read some of these kind of scary propositions. And that one of them is that the way our agribusiness is done is that, and similar to the ways God's judged Israel and even the Babylonian people in 4,000 years ago, that if you plow up every inch of land right to the edge of the river, eventually it's going to tap the resources of the land. If you don't let things lie fallow every once in a while to renew and refresh and rejuvenate, things are going to get distorted, and we've lost track of that balanced use of land and living with the cycles and rhythms of the land, as you were saying, because of greed. I don't know if you want to share any more
I forgot the man's name, but he was talking about how God was punishing the Midwest because they favored abortions. Some of the fanatical groups are saying, you know, that these are the last days, if you look in Book of Revelations, it always talked about flooding and killing
natural
and
disasters.
And so a lot of fanatical groups are leaning towards, well, we've been here for 2,000 years almost, and Christ hasn't come back, so he's got to come back soon. So they're saying that, you know, they're leaning towards now the Book of Revelation, saying that these are going to be the last days, and so they're saying that God's getting ready for the final punch. I don't favor that, because I think that a lot of people, well, I know that my God doesn't do that to anyone that without whatever reason, and that I believe it's more of a healing, kind of the flooding was more of a healing than a wound, more of a rejuvenation of new life in the soil with the water coming in and putting in new stuff.
There was some loss of life, though.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when we think in Bangladesh, even if it's as Ruther says, two aspects of the same problem, that we've misused and abused both people and the way then these people can live on the land because of our greed and at least the people in power, which are mainly male, white, European-based
descent.
It's not God's design that human life be destroyed, but it is our doing. Does that make some sense? Right, yeah.
Well, it seems that it's built into the Christian practice, at least if not Christian faith, that we we assume that God is favoring us or not favoring us in matters of weather.
Mm-hmm.
In times of drought, churches pray for rain.
Mm-hmm. It's in our Vespers liturgy, you know, there's all this mm-hmm. weather.
Yeah.
That we think God can control it for our benefit?
Yeah. In times of in good years, we thank God for the bountiful harvest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can fully understand the mentality that develops that God is making decisions season by season or country by country, because we constantly ask God to do something to make things better, and we thank God when things are good.
So are we blaming
God?
Are we blaming God? Yeah.
So
we're missing out on some of the wisdom. Is that what your point is? Or?
Well, I'm wondering whether this is a completely erroneous way of thinking about the relationship between God and the natural order.
Mm-hmm.
Or if everything is a whole and God is working in nature and through nature, as I understood Luther to be saying, and that we should understand that what happens in natural events ought to be God at work in the world.
But maybe not in the ways that we've been interpreting, you know, like, okay, this happened and then this happened. It must mean the two things are related. And in good science, we learn that two phenomena occurring together doesn't necessarily mean they have anything to do with each other. So,
but when you quoted her, when she says we are just in life, you know, this world has been going a long time before we ever entered it.
We're specks, as Job found out.
That we may leave too. I mean, we may, you know, disappear and the earth will be healed again. But that we can't take ourselves so seriously.
Can we take the 2 million people that died in the last 12 years in Bangladesh as pretty seriously?
Then you have to look. Yeah. I can't make a statement on that
That's a way of God controlling the population in those overpopulated. Seems like a brutal thing, but it could very
it's
well
just
be
the
a reality.
You're saying once again that God is in doing all this stuff, that God's creating evil in some way.
But we believe Gaia is a living cell. The earth has to renew itself and kill off. Killing off is part of the circle.
That's There's too many people for the last...
You just see, there's a sea in the middle of Australia. I just got back from Australia, that's the reason why I'm talking so much about it. But there's a sea in the middle of Australia that about every 7 years becomes a sea. And the fish come to it, and all these birds come to it. I mean, it's a sanctuary. But as it dries up, animals stay too long to have their babies or do all this stuff, and they all die out. Mm-hmm. And it happens every 7 years. Now, if these animals were, you know, would have this inside their genes and remember to leave in time. But I mean, this is, but it's part of nature. There is death in nature all the time. Mm. And we think human life so precious. We do that because of our, you know, we think this, but I think human life is part of nature.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would like to be careful about that, because there's also the strand in there that says we are to value every precious life.
It could end in a butterfly, though. I mean, we should honor everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's one of
the quandaries, I think, that this book lays out, is that we are set with the horrendous task of trying to understand why there are, and that's one of the questions that you brought up at the very beginning of the discussion, I did want to get back to. Why is there such destruction? You know, is it God's judgment? Does God act that directly? And does he wipe out, or wipe out populations for reasons that we really don't know, or can't, or do we have the responsibility to find out if we in fact have distorted God's plan in some way? And I think there's some a lot of in this book and in a lot of the recent wisdom that is being written on, and knowledge that is being accumulated because of some of these disasters, that we have distorted God's plan in our use of the land.
I think we should hear from Mark, the Native American viewer. This is important. I may put you on the spot, but I know
that. One of the first comments I was going to come back to you on was that you mentioned Bangladesh and the trouble that was going on there. I think, not to try to answer what God might be thinking, but ends up one of the things that I was looking at it as maybe in a sense that he's finding out, you know, how much we really care for our fellow human beings. That are we doing the really the right actions in taking care of humanity, and if we are not, then we're not doing what actually I think God is asking us to do.
So you're saying it's a test?
A test, yeah. That if there are things going on within the world that, and we're not addressing, like when they mentioned hunger and droughts and taking care of the earth and respecting other natures and making sure life continues and we don't abuse it. And
we've been given the caretakership of this this area, and so it is in our hands, not to control but to understand and to
educate,
to seek out answers to, you know, well, why do some of these disasters happen? And is it our ignoring some of the wisdom?
Our standing up and addressing it.
Mm-hmm. Is it our ignorance in not doing some of the other things that God has also commanded us to do, to watch out for the weak and the oppressed, and to care for widows and children and orphans, to make sure that every human being is well cared for. Even if we had a little more time, I'd read about the whole sabbatical, you know, scenario that's laid out, that every human and every animal by declaration in the Leviticus is to be given rest and refreshment.
Yeah, after 7 years, 1 year off for everybody. And after 7 times 7, a jubilee where everything goes back to normal. All the rich people, everyone, everything's redistributed again. We start all over again.
Yeah.
So every 49 years, everything we get the same amount, and then we'll try it over again.
Like that.
Wouldn't that be just the most radical thing?
It's God's plan. We thought if Hebrews could do this, and everyone else would see it, they'd think, this is a good way, let's try this.
That's why I think if we're God trying to control the population, it would not be meted out on the weak. No. It would probably be, he'd probably destroy the United States, Western Europe, and Japan.
Why?
Because we're the highest consumptive economies. They wouldn't need to raise cash crops anymore.
We're the most wasteful of all of the resources.
We would be sucking out all these cash. They could then grow all the crops they need for their own area. These were colonial structures. I mean, let's admit it. I mean, they were colonial structures. Would we be willing to deal without
fruits in the winter? Or
how
coffee?
About coffee? All this coffee we drink. how about chocolate? You want to do without chocolate? No more cocoa beans, because we're not going to have that anymore. And keep going. I mean, just keep going and find out where all your cheap shirts come from. You know, when you're wearing a shirt on the back, it was probably made by a kid in Bangladesh in a factory or something. Mm-hmm. And you bought it from Walmart. I mean, you know, people don't think about, we cause them to be there, we cause them to remain there, we benefit from their death.
Wait, so are you saying that capitalism is wrong?
No, I'm not saying that it's wrong, it's wrongly made in the sense that if capitalism is what you worship, then it is wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the buck is...
If that's the highest priority.
If it's the highest priority. However, if it is that you make a sustainable, and I don't mean sustainable by armies, but sustainable economy that benefits all, that it's an equal barter thing where people trade and there are resources here that aren't elsewhere, and we trade our spices and things along certain trade routes, that benefits everybody. But where you have sucking out the resources of another area and use them as cheap labor to produce goods for you, that's slavery. That's not... And that's what God, I think, is against. The other thing is the Judaic strand that we've lost. When you were talking about that, a number of other people were talking, remind me all the festivals that we don't celebrate in the Christian religion. We don't have Sukkot. We don't put our shacks up and celebrate the harvest. We don't have Pesach. We don't have Passover. We should more get
Which
into,
they're kind of seasonal celebrations.
Well, not only that, you actually think about what you put in your mouth and what it means, and it has this connection with God, and it's, you know, all this sort of thing. And you really care about what you're doing there. All those are rather important. And the other thing, sense that I get, is look at Israel. I mean, Israel has its problems, but they reclaimed deserts. They went back to old techniques. They lived with the land. They went back to terracing, which is an old technique. And when you get back in that kind of relationship and kibbutzes and things like that, which are not centers of, you know, capitalistic enterprise, sometimes they make a profit, but they're, you know, more communal type centers, you find that the nation prospers a lot more.
So are you talking about pure socialism or basically you?
No. But Rosemary Ruther speaks of even in that model that the Israelites were living under, both in the Babylonian captivity and in with their own kings, is that the voice of power and law speaking in authority, and we do have, you know, countries and peoples that are more powerful than others. But what I think is the unique Judaic gift to us is that those authorities and those kings and powers and laws speak in its most balanced way on behalf of the weak, and as that there are mandates to protect the powerless and to restrain the power of the mighty, you know, so that it doesn't become absolute power. And and forget the original power or source of life and power. I don't know if I can say it in another way. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That we should not forget that we are not the ones in charge. And you know, there I did want to discuss that very problem, that you know, if no matter what kind of economy you have, there are, it is human nature, it seems, and that's why this sabbatical year was proposed, to, well, just wipe out that natural tendency of human nature to kind of accumulate stuff for ourselves and our friends and those in our class and our family. And that we and God's laws are to correct that distorted way of thinking and that selfish way of thinking. Does that make sense?
The story of the manna, if you go through that, they collected it for 2 days, it smelled, they got maggots on it. But on Friday for Saturday before their Sabbath, the maggots must have known not to get into it.
Maggots
they
were saved
it for one day to the next day, so they didn't have to pick it up on the Sabbath.
The maggots had Sabbath.
Oh, that's a good idea.
That's Rosemary Ruther would say that is sacramental thinking.
Yeah. But hoarding is not a healthy thing.
It gets it out of balance.
It's because we don't trust that the manna will come again the next day and every day. Mm-hmm. So we store up for the bad years. Or the
winter
of the day, or the winter.
Or for midnight snacks.
Or our own kind. But without that mandate to think of others, that God has said, we are to consider all of our community, which is the whole human family, and the welfare. Yeah.
I'd like to put in a plug for Mary Schramm's appearance in my exhibit, and her concern with sufficiency.
Yes.
And that concept of sufficiency. And
what is sufficient?
Yeah.
Well, all of our living, even though we might live in a nice house and have two cars and that kind of stuff, but not to keep accumulating. When you have what you need, stop.
Otherwise
you know?
You become fat.
Otherwise what?
You become fat.
Right. But your house becomes fat. How many houses have you been into where you open a cupboard to get a towel or something and falls out at you? I mean, we accumulate.
Sufficiency
we don't
again.
To. Yeah, it's not sufficient. Mm-hmm.
So then we should join the Peace Corps and go out and teach the poor of the world how to help themselves. In other words, don't force it down their neck, but teach them how to farm better and build terraces again and get clean water. And
that's what we've been doing in Wellspring, is helping
them
build
wells. I mean, that's exactly, if there are too many poor people, then we should be out there sharing, not to give up everything ourselves, but to go out to teach them how to help themselves.
Mm-hmm. And to learn from them, to receive from them all the things that they can teach us.
If everybody was old and would live sufficiently instead of greedily, you know, we touch a lot of lives up here.
Now, how many thousand people come here per year? A few thousand, at least.
Yeah, 6,000.
Wow.
That if we can just make, I mean, just not to be consumers, you know, not to buy in to the world's, you got to have the newest this or the best this or the coolest this or the... Mm-hmm.
No, but it's human nature. Basically, I heard a seminar based on this kind of need for the newest stuff and technology, of having newer technology and having better things. And that's, nothing's wrong with that, but the thing is, it gives you a false sense of security, saying that over time, that with technology you don't need God and you don't need it, and you've got this technology which gives you this kind of this security blanket.
A sense of control.
Like, right, and a sense of control, like, hey, I am God, I can make messages go from here at this moment to Japan right now, and they can get this book or they can get this message, whatever I have to say, with satellites or whatever. And so that's
what happens if the transformer up the river goes out? you know, a whole city goes dark and all its computers too.
Not will they here in the Northwest, a huge storm came through the Northwest.
Yeah.
None of us saw the inaugural, you know, not that well, we're gonna watch it anyway. But there was no power and there was no, I mean, it stopped everything. So you're right back to keeping warm with blankets and candles and heating water.
Well, this whole concept of the consumerism, I met a fellow about a year or so ago who was a fanatic, and he was a self-proclaimed fanatic about working towards overpopulation awareness. And it took me about a couple months. I was working, I was unemployed, and I was working in a copy store making copies. And he would come at 6 o'clock in the morning, so it'd just be this fanatic and me alone in the copy store. And he was sort of goofy looking, too, to boot. And so, you know, it was...
it's like, have your hand on the phone.
Yeah. It was hard to take him seriously initially, but he was a very articulate person. And he also was very systematic in his research. And ultimately, after a couple of months, I embraced what he was talking about to the extent where I edited his newsletter from there on. And bottom line, you know, his argument is based on the fact that it's quite clear that whenever there is a species that surpasses its carrying capacity in the area that it's populating, there are a series of things that happen to decimate that population down to a point where the area can regenerate enough in order to support the lower numbers in the population. And he shows real clearly that, you know, throughout human history there have been times when the population has gone beyond the carrying capacity of the area that it was in, and then you get all sorts of icky things happening, and then they move on to different areas like Australia, like the United States, like South America, and now there's no place left to move, and we have surpassed our carrying capacity by a long shot, and that's why there's the decimation of the rainforest, that's why there's the, you know, ozone depletion, that's why blah 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 blah, because we've got consumers beyond what there is left to healthily consume, and people keep on cranking out new consumers and lots of them when we're already beyond the critical mass point.
Does he propose some answers, or
is it primitive nature though, for one to be a consumer? Like, I know, like, when you have 2 and 3 year olds, they go through a stage of mine.
Everything is mine.
Yes, and so is it primitive nature for...
Well, you have to consume to live. I mean, it's that simple.
But you don't have to over-consume.
You don't have to over-consume.
Right. Okay.
You don't have to have 10 kids either.
Right.
What are some of the solutions that this guy has proposed?
He says the best case scenario at this point is just simply stop having kids, you know, period. And because the more consumers you put out there, you know, the more there is to make the situation, to make it more rapid, the decimation of the population.
So he's a zero population person.
Yep.
Less than zero if nobody has.
However, he knows, even in his fanaticism, that that's not realistic.
You know,
to say, but that if you ask people, please just have one child. Just one.
That's,
you know,
what they tried to institute in China.
Yeah. Right. And China wasn't that stupid in that deal.
Yeah, but the abortion level was very high. We wanted a boy child, not a girl child, and you wouldn't believe the killing of babies.
And when you live in a culture where half or a third of the children are going to die of starvation or malnutrition, it's a natural instinct to want to have several so that
you can guarantee
a child who grows up.
Reuther spends quite a bit of time on the population problem here and really latches onto the research from the World Watch Institute. You may see that showing up in this guy's newsletter. That... She agrees also that, you know, if we're going to double the Earth's population in the next 35 years, the same way that we've doubled it in the last 35 years, none of our ecological ideas about how to recycle or use the land a little better get rid of PCBs or whatever, all those other ideas that I also wanted to share about how we're doing in our own communities, but it won't make a difference whatsoever, because she says we will be pretty much wiped out either by the war of whoever has the most weapons will get food, or by famine or disease. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't really like either of those alternatives, and she says now is the time to act. She also has, can I read a little bit? I think this is the best of the research that's happened on population problems most recently.